I have to start with some apologies, and that's the first apology is the state of my presentation or my paper. Yeah, in critistic in ordinary sense, I think, like the first,
mine?
The preliminary to something more coherent. And one of the reasons for that is that the actual paper is quite long, and the first part of it has to do with, well, the paper is about Wittgenstein's remark on the delta M, it's got this odd, strange resemblance between a philosophical investigation and an aesthetic investigation. And as Kjell said, I knew that Kjell is going to talk about the remark in a more general way, and I was sort of hoping to just piggyback on Kjell and have him do the groundwork, and then I would like to comment specifically on something that is mostly left out, or at least uncommented, when this remark is quoted or adduced, and it's Wittgenstein's parenthetical remark about that the philosophical investigation, especially in mathematics, has a strange resemblance to an aesthetic investigation. Why does he talk about this philosophical investigation, especially in mathematics? And when I first encountered this remark, I sort of just bypassed it. I thought, this sounds very strange, and I don't know anything about mathematics anyway, so I can just ignore it. But this has actually prompted me now lately, when I came back to this remark some years ago, when I was writing a piece on Wittgenstein's philosophy of mathematics, I sort of try to get. I'm a newcomer to the field, but I sort of try to get some idea of what Wittgenstein is doing in this philosophy of mathematics. And then, after having sort of started with that, I think I could glimpse or understand why he perhaps wanted to pick up on especially the philosophy of mathematics in this remark. But before I start properly, I will distribute a handout of quotations. I hope I have enough on this. Okay. And the handout is a bit intimidating. It has like 35 quotations, but I will go through all of them. And the first part is mostly from the part I will try to skip, but I would like to make some comments about what Kjell said too. I think I have a couple more here, but of course I will go through all these quotations, but I will, we can use them as a point of reference. But let's start out with the quotations 1 and 2, and quotation 1 is the quotation from Cyril Barrett that Kjell also quoted yesterday. And Cyril Barrett, this is not a commentary on Wittgenstein's remark, because that was not known at the time, but this is from a discussion of Wittgenstein's lectures on aesthetics, which, as you know, Cyril edited. And Cyril says in this discussion that it might be argued, however, that broadly understood, there's a great deal of aesthetics in Wittgenstein's work, and that aesthetics, and this is important, as he conceived it, is the paradigm philosophy also as he conceived it. And I think it's important, if you want to understand Wittgenstein's remark about the Selbstsamähnlichkeit, to note that he's talking about aesthetics as he conceived it, and philosophy also as he conceived it. But then I also have this other remark about Wittgenstein's philosophy. It's from a paper by Juliette Floyd. And this paper, Juliette Floyd wants to say that it's not aesthetics, but the philosophy of mathematics that somehow epitomizes all of Wittgenstein's philosophy. And this is the quotation number 2, which I won't read out here. But there, Floyd also makes an important point by taking up this idea of Übersichtlichkeit. Darstellung, and which she means is especially important for the philosophy of mathematics. And I would like to argue, though I don't know if I have time to do this, that it is especially the idea of a synoptic presentation or an Übersichtliche Darstellung that is at least an important aspect of this strange resemblance. And Kjell was already hinting at this yesterday. Okay, and then we need to go on to quotations 3 and 4. These are the quotations, or this is the remark I'm interested in. The odd resemblance of philosophical investigation, perhaps especially in mathematics, and an aesthetic one, for example. What's that about this garment? How it should be, and so on. And then the longer version of the same remark. I don't really know if we have time to do this, but this is something I actually would like to discuss perhaps later. But this is a bit not nerdy, but it's about the dating of these remarks and these manuscripts. Because Kjell said, and I'm not quite sure where you got your dating, but you said that the manuscript 119 would be from May 1937. And
116 the other way around.
Yes, 116 from May and 119 from November.
From late in the autumn, yeah.
Yes, but I would like to, at least based on purely textual evidence, I would like to say that manuscript 119 is the first version, because it's written in a much more sketchy manner. And also if you look at the surrounding discussion, it's the same discussion, but it's much more polished in 1116. And in 1119, we have, for example, he even writes philosophician instead of philosophician. So it seems to be written in haste, but this is something I haven't really gotten into. I haven't even looked at the facsimiles or anything like that. But I don't know if Alois has any comments on this.
It, yeah.
Because of course, this seems like a minor point, but one of my points is, and this is perhaps contestable, but I think that we have to understand this remark as Wittgenstein's reflection of his own procedures. He's not talking about philosophy in general, and this is not an aphorism about philosophy that just comes out of the blue, but he's reflecting on what he's doing at the time. And at that time, as Alois pointed out, he had he was 30. I'm not good at these datings, but he had at least began the first version of the Philosophical, the free version of the Philosophical Satufungen. And I think that part of what he's doing is reflecting upon his new way of writing philosophy. This is perhaps a bit speculative, but still, I think we have to look at this remark in its context. As Wittgenstein says himself about understanding a sentence or a proposition, we have to look at the Umgebung, or the context of a sentence in order to understand it. And of course there are different kinds of Umgebung for this remark. We have, the one surrounding is the immediate surrounding in the manuscript, what he's writing in that manuscript. And the other surrounding is what he was doing at the time, philosophically. And actually this first context, the Nahlas context, Nahlas specific context, is something I really haven't looked at. I have just recently, a couple of weeks ago, I took a second look at this manuscript. And actually noticed, as I said yesterday, that I think this remark is connected to what he's writing in those manuscripts. Even though, for example, von Wright takes the remark, publishes this remark in Culture and Value, and he says, that the remarks he has taken out are sort of remarks that seem to be disconnected from the immediate discussion surrounding those remarks. And this remark seems to be like that Wittgenstein is discussing different things. He's discussing sense experience, how we can speak, or is it possible to speak of a new sense or new kind of sense impression, and so on. And then suddenly, it seems, this remark comes, and then the discussion continues. But I think if you look closer at the discussion in the manuscript, this remark can also be seen as a comment to what he's doing right there in that discussion. But But this part of my paper, this isn't even anything I have written out, so I don't know how much time I can spend on this, but I would like to, I just say some few words about that context in the manuscripts, and then I will go on and discuss this remark more generally. Sorry, I have to change my glasses here. Actually, the discussion here in this manuscript is it's really interesting because it has to do with the distinction between sense and nonsense. And in fact, some of the discussion, at least in manuscript 1R6, found its way into the philosophical investigations around paragraph 250 and around paragraph 500 in investigations. There is a discussion of nonsense which actually is taken or occurs in this manuscript. Well, if you look at a few pages before the actual remark, he's talking about what is a proposition or what is a sentence. And then he talks about nonsense, what makes sentence nonsense, what is a nonsensical sentence. And his example is, for example, the nonsense poetry of Lewis Carroll. And he says that a sentence is nonsensical if it has what he calls a Satzklang. If it sounds like a sentence, as it actually doesn't have any sense, then we will talk about sentence. But any arbitrary combination of signs is not nonsense because, you know, it doesn't even give the illusion of, well, he doesn't talk about the illusion, but it doesn't even give the impression of being or it doesn't sound like a sentence. If it doesn't have a Satzklang, then you can't even talk about nonsense. Nonsense is something that is formed or understood on the analogy of simple, what's that in English? Simple. Yeah, but the opposition to nonsensical is, it's not sensical, right? But it's
intelligible.
Right. Yeah. I mean, the opposition to. So, a nonsensical sentence is understood on the analogy of an intelligible sentence, a non-nonsensical sentence. And then he gives some examples of this, and then he talks about the example of, I can talk about dividing an apple, and then I can talk about dividing red. But dividing red, we want to say, is nonsense, but it sounds like an intelligible sentence. But it's nonsense because these words are not given any sense in our language. They are not part of the language game here in the manuscript. And the sentence is not nonsense if we can use it for some purpose. I can. This is very interesting in itself, but as I said, this is just, you know, I'm just quoting here from the manuscript. I haven't really thought this through. But then he also said something like it's not like that it's ungrammatical what makes a sentence nonsensical, and not really the rules that you tell us which sentences are nonsensical, but it's that actually that we cannot use them in our language. And if we can use a sentence in our language, then it's no longer nonsense. For example, the sentence I divide red can be used with Fishman speculates, at least in some Umgebung where it actually makes sense. And then he discusses this idea about imagining a new sense or a new sense experience, whether that kind of sentence can be given any sense in language. Then there actually, and I will come back to this, then there is a small passage about mathematics, actually, or philosophy of mathematics, which I will come back to. And then we have the remark about the strange resemblance, and then in the discussion goes on about nonsense and what nonsense could actually be, and how I can discover that a sentence has sense. So this is a very interesting discussion, but as I said, I haven't really had time to look into it. But we could have a look at the. I made a sort of rough translation of the passage about mathematics, but this is a bad translation, or just a rough draft. I just made it on the plate on the way here. But this is quotation number 12. We can just jump to it in this syncretistic manner. And I believe this is Wittgenstein writing in the both manuscripts actually, but this is from manuscript 116. Hardy says in the paper Mathematica Proof that the finite cannot understand the infinite should surely be a theological and not a mathematical war cry. And the Wittgenstein goes on. He actually quoted this in English, but the rest of the expression is in German. It is true that this expression is infelicitous. But what those who use it want to say with it is, we have to deal with right things here. Whence this leap from the finite to the infinite? And it is not a completely nonsensical way of expressing oneself. Only the finite that is not supposed to be able to think the infinite is not a human being or our understanding, but a calculus. And precisely how it thinks the infinite is well worth an investigation. The goal is a surveyable and comprehensive presentation, and it is easily to the Darstellung. Of all uses and illustrations of and beliefs about the characters, an all-sided lighting, because one-sided lighting also throws a shadow. A complete overview, see the dots are missing, of everything that might cause unclarity. And this overview must cover a wide area because the roots of our ideas reach far. So it is difficult to make discriminations. The finite cannot understand the infinite means it cannot happen in the way you, in characteristic shallow manner, present it. So, okay, this is the discussion here in the manuscript is rather sketchy and incomplete, but I think that we can at least, if we read this in a certain spirit, we can perhaps glimpse that there could be thought to exist some sort of resemblance between this kind of philosophical investigation and what Wittgenstein calls an aesthetic investigation. Now that we know, and I think Kjell was on the right track when he yesterday talked about what Wittgenstein actually means with an aesthetic investigation. If we think of that kind of investigation and the philosophical investigation, we can perhaps glimpse something of that strange resemblance. And I would like to claim that it is this idea of presenting a surveyable Übersichtliche Darstellung and Übersicht that is the sort of link between the philosophical investigation and the aesthetic investigation. At least one of the aspects linking the philosophical and the aesthetic investigation. And the mathematical investigation in philosophy of mathematics in this case would be an investigation of the concept of infinity, or the infinite. Here Wittgenstein hints, for example, that finite is certainly misleading, but on the other hand, there is some point that people are trying to make when they say things like this, that the finite cannot understand the infinite. But we should understand it in certain sense, and then, you know, get rid of the false analogies, he says, and the pictures that might mislead us through this kind of Übersichtliche Darstellung. Okay, but this part of my paper, it's not really even a part of my paper, but this is part of the context where we have to understand Gestalt Mark of the Seltsame Ähnlichkeit. But I would now like to try to say something more about the other context, and that's Wittgenstein's activity at the time, because it's very interesting to note that Wittgenstein wrote this in 37, probably the autumn of 37, and I guess he was here at his hut, perhaps, even writing this. But the next year, he, as you know, lectured in aesthetics, and also shortly afterwards he lectured on the foundations of mathematics. So, if Wittgenstein is actually thinking about or talking about his own philosophy here, we could perhaps expect to find, you know, something in his own way of working that gives us some clues on how to understand this Seltsame Ähnlichkeit. But the Seltsame Ähnlichkeit would perhaps show in his way of working at the time. And the further argument is that the closest we come to his way of working are these transcripts of the lectures, even though they are not his own words, they are, you know, at least give us some idea of how he presented his ideas to, not to only to himself, but to other people. So that's why I put quite a lot of weight on the lectures, on this, both on the lectures on aesthetics and the lectures on the foundations of mathematics. Now, let's see, what am I doing here? Not very well. So I think I'll just go very, very quickly through the first part of my paper, which has to do more generally to do with the self-samajenlichkeit, and where I try to say something about what Wittgenstein means by aesthetic investigation, and here I'm much in agreement with and indebted with Chell's interpretation and what it is about philosophical investigation. I think, for example, what Cavell says here about the kind of philosophical investigation that Cavell thinks Wittgenstein is doing would fit very well into this kind of aesthetic investigation Wittgenstein is talking about, for example, in quotations 6 and 7, he's talking about, I would like to say, an aesthetic, and 8 are examples of things Wittgenstein would perhaps want to call aesthetic investigation. And then the other quotations in the first part, under the method part of my handout are three quotations where I try to point out places where we can see that it is the idea of a synopsis of triviality that somehow makes the connection between aesthetics and philosophy, and also ethics, as Wittgenstein said in the early 30s. But we can perhaps discuss that, if you want, we can discuss that more in detail later. So I assume that we have established, if we believe in what Chell said, for example, that there is perhaps some sort of resemblance between a philosophical investigation and an aesthetic investigation, as Wittgenstein understood them. But the question remains, why mathematics? Why does he want to point out the philosophical investigation, especially in mathematics? And the question I want to ask more specifically is about the local content of this. As I said, I assume that Wittgenstein is talking about his own philosophy, and actually his own approach at that time to philosophy. So how does his own approach relate to this analogy? Does it give examples of how he himself perceived the odd resemblance or strange resemblance? Okay, now I come to my actual paper. In the lectures on aesthetics from 1938, for example, examples from mathematics do not play any significant role at all. But it's interesting to note that Wittgenstein does in passing touch upon an issue relating to the philosophy of mathematics at the end of his third lecture. And interestingly, this occurs when he characterizes his own way of philosophizing as a kind of persuasion, in which he wants to draw attention to certain differences, he says, and get his interlocutor to look at things in another way. And here he brings in Cantor's statement about set theory as an example of a way of thinking he wants to combat. He says that he's in, and this is quotation number 13, he says that he, Wittgenstein, is in a sense making propaganda for a style of thinking as opposed to another, and that he is honestly disgusted with the other, that is Cantor's way of thinking. Cantor's proof and manner of expression has no charm for him. He hates it, he says. And he wants to put it, for instance, an expression like the cardinal number of all cardinal numbers in a way in which it loses its charm, as he says. So this means that he wants to show how misleading such expressions are. I think that we can hear quite clearly, at least bring some parallels to what Wittgenstein calls aesthetic investigations. But is this really what Wittgenstein meant by philosophical investigation in mathematics? These elliptical remarks from the aesthetics lectures are not very informative and hardly qualify as a valid philosophical criticism, much less as a philosophical investigation in mathematics. But in his lectures on the foundations of mathematics, which he delivered shortly after his lectures on aesthetics, I think that was in the spring of 1939, Wittgenstein developed these thoughts in a way that allows us to understand the strange resemblance more clearly. That's my argument. Of course, Wittgenstein's critique of set theory is one of the most controversial features of his philosophy of mathematics, and many of his critics argue that Wittgenstein here dismisses a legitimate area of mathematics without any good reason. So will not those critics just get more wind in their face if we bring in Wittgenstein's comparison between an aesthetic investigation and a philosophical investigation in mathematics here? Does this not mean that such an investigation is simply based on personal preferences and make Wittgenstein's criticism philosophically quite irrelevant? This is of course a serious accusation, but the question remains whether it is justified. So let us now see how a philosophical investigation in mathematics is to proceed according to Wittgenstein, and take his criticism of Cantor as our example. So what are the expressions of Cantor that disgust Wittgenstein? Well, his criticism is particularly aimed at the central aspect of Cantor's theory, and that is Cantor's way of introducing concepts like actual infinity and transfinite cardinal. I don't know how much knowledge of Cantor's theory I can assume here, but I don't like to spend much time on presenting Cantor's theory either, so this is a bit of a dilemma for me. But I could say very briefly that, you know, Cantor understands cardinal number or cardinality as a generalization of natural numbers. And the cardinality of set A for Cantor is the number of elements of that set. So the natural numbers for Cantor are sets with a certain number of elements. Every natural number n can be viewed as a set with n elements. But then if we introduce sets of infinite size, the natural numbers are not enough as cardinal numbers. And therefore Cantor introduced transfinite cardinals, which he denoted with the symbol R. And according to Cantor, every transfinite set must have a distinct R as its cardinal number. And the move Cantor makes is that he actually distinguishes an infinite number of distinct transfinite sets, which each has an individual R number. For example, the natural numbers as the cardinal number R is null, that's an infinite set. I don't know how much I want to say about this. The natural numbers are countably infinite, but Cantor introduces the idea of uncountably infinite sets. And the rational numbers, for example, are uncountably infinite. And that this means that the set of real numbers, are more numerous, Cantor says, than natural numbers. All this begins to sound rather mind-boggling. In Cantor's system, we then have Aleph null as the first cardinal number, but then we have an infinite amount of Alephs, or cardinal transfinite cardinal numbers. So what's central for Cantor is that there is an infinite number of infinitely large sets that can be described by the Aleph numbers. And then he also introduces very special rules for counting among the transfinite cardinals. For example, Aleph null plus 0 equals Aleph null. Aleph null plus 1 equals Aleph null. Aleph null plus Aleph null equals Aleph null. But 2 in the power of Aleph null equals Aleph 1, and so on. So all this begins to sound quite mind-boggling. And that's what Cantor himself thought. He actually went crazy thinking about this. But this is what something that Wittgenstein wants to oppose. This aspect of that we get sort of dizzy when we begin thinking about this, that's the aspect he wants us to resist. But Cantor's theory, well, and one aspect of Cantor's theory is famous diagonal proof, and the diagonal proof is a proof that the real numbers are more numerous than the natural numbers, or that the set of the real numbers is uncountable. But I don't think, especially since we don't have a blackboard here, I won't go into the diagonal proof. It's not really very difficult to understand, but Wittgenstein thinks that it doesn't, on the whole, show what Cantor supposes that it shows. Anyway, Cantor's set theory was subject of much controversy, but many mathematicians finally welcomed it as an enrichment of mathematics and new possibility to account for the foundations of mathematics. And in this context, David Hilbert's famous turn of phrase is often quoted, and this is what I allude to in my title, and this is quotation number 16. From a paradise Cantor created for us, no one shall expel us. And Cantor's paradise is often understood as this realm of infinity, or to transfinite numbers. And in Cantor's paradise, we can form sets without any restrictions. Cantor himself thought that he had discovered, and this is important, that he had discovered a new and unconstrained mathematical reality, and that transfinite set theory was confirmation of the fact, which is expressed in quotation 14. Cantor says the essence of mathematics lies precisely in its freedom. Set theory, as he conceives it, becomes a kind of scientific description of this so-called paradise. Thus, he thinks that we must distinguish, for example. I'll jump over this. Cantor's early proofs for the transfinite are characterized by a kind of religiously based metaphysics. If you look, for example, at quotation 15 from Cantor, he says, that, however, an infinitum creatum as existence must be assumed can be proven in several ways. One proof proceeds from the concept of God and concludes, first of all, from the highest perfection of God's being, the possibility of the creation of a transfinitum ordinatum, then from his benevolence and magnificence, the necessity of the actual ensued creation of a transfinitum. Another proof shows a posteriori that the assumption of the transfinitum in natura naturata renders possible a better because more perfect explanation of the phenomena, especially the organism and psychical manifestations, than the first in hypothesis. But what, according to Wittgenstein, presents a problem for the philosophy of mathematics here? To clarify this, we need to understand what Wittgenstein says is the object of a philosophical study of mathematics. It is not mathematics, but what we attempted to say about mathematics, that is what we could call the raw material of philosophy. Let's look at quotation 17 here. Wittgenstein says this is in the investigation. That's, for example, what a mathematician is inclined to say about the objectivity and reality of mathematical facts. It's not the philosophy of mathematics, but something for philosophical treatment. And it is this philosophical treatment that of Wittgenstein is the philosophical investigation in mathematics. And the example from Hardy, which I quoted, would be another example, or at least the sentence that Hardy quotes, is an example of such material for philosophical treatment. It's an example of what mathematicians are inclined to say about infinity, for example. And the things that Cantor says about his so-called discovery are things that are something for philosophical treatment. And it is this philosophical treatment that I would say has this odd resemblance to, at least sometimes can have the odd resemblance to what Wittgenstein wants to call an aesthetic investigation. Wittgenstein also puts this in different forms in other places, for example, quotation 18. Philosophy does not review the calculi of the mathematician, but only what mathematicians say about the calculi. And also at other places in another similar expressions. Consequently, Wittgenstein does not try to refute set theory or prove that it leads to contradictions and false results. He's not a mathematician. For Wittgenstein, a philosophical investigation in mathematics is, as mentioned, not a mathematical investigation. Philosophy should not interfere with mathematics and its development. It leaves, as Wittgenstein famously puts it, everything as it is. It also leaves mathematics as it is, and no mathematical discovery can advance it, as he puts it in the investigation on 24. According to Wittgenstein, what leads to philosophical problems of puzzlement is Cantor's statements about his discovery. We do not have to do with a mistake. It's not that Cantor would say anything false, but with a delusion or a way of thinking which lends the concepts of set theory, as Wittgenstein would say, to false and misleading or even dangerous charm. The problem Wittgenstein wants to point out is what is said about mathematics, about numbers, calculations, mathematical objects, and so on, can help create a mythology that gives a charm to the numbers or calculi, but also contributes to obscure their actual use in mathematics. That is what actually determines their significance, the Umgebung in actual mathematical practice. This does not mean that he would want to expel mathematicians from what Hilbert called a paradise, but he wants us to realize ourselves that there is no such paradise. Quotation 19. I would say, and this is a response to Hilbert, it's Wittgenstein talking in his lecture, I wouldn't dream of trying to drive anyone out of this paradise. I would try to do something quite different. I would try to show you that it is no paradise, so that you leave on your own accord. I would say, you're welcome to this, just look about you. And once again, we can glimpse the similarity to an aesthetic investigation. It's not enough that somebody just tells you, or tells us, that this paradise doesn't exist, or tells us that it is a mistake to consider of set theory in this way. Instead, Wittgenstein wants his, to get his addressee to realize for himself or herself that there is no paradise by looking around, that is, by noticing the mathematical surroundings of the central concepts of set theory. This is in quotation 20, the end of the quotation. If we explain the surroundings of the expression, we see that the thing could have been expressed in an entirely different way. I can put it in a way in which it will lose its charm for a great number of people, and certainly will lose its charm for me. But what then is the form of expression Wittgenstein here refers to? It is not too speculative to assume that he refers precisely to a kind of synopsis of triviality that will help us to see the matter in the right light. And I would argue that it is precisely such a method or form of presentation that Wittgenstein himself uses, both in his manuscripts from the late 1930s and especially in his lectures on the foundations of mathematics in 39, when he deals with set theory and infinity. And I think this is also corroborated by Wittgenstein's own statements about what he's doing. He devoted his whole first lecture to describe his own approach, and he wanted to make his audience aware, and this is number 21, that his investigation is to draw your attention to facts you know quite as well as I, but which you have forgotten, or at least which are not immediately in your field of vision. They will be quite trivial facts. I won't say anything which anyone can dispute. And I also always take comfort in this remark when I'm trying to understand Wittgenstein's remarks on the philosophy of mathematics, because he says he's only talking about trivial things. It's not, of course, not quite true, but mostly, the things he's saying are understandable without having any higher mathematics. And I guess that his students, Turing was one of the students, and he's obviously a mathematician, but most of the students are not mathematicians. But in what sense are the facts he presents trivial? At least in two senses. Firstly, he wants to emphasize that he, as a philosopher, is entitled to talk about mathematics only because, this Wittgenstein himself saying, because he says, I just deal with puzzlement that originates from the words in our everyday language, such as evidence, number, series, and so on. So this is one aspect of the triviality. The second aspect is that he emphasizes that all these examples come from elementary mathematics. And this is, of course, something that has led many mathematicians and philosophers to contend that Wittgenstein's philosophy of mathematics is trivial in the negative sense. That is, that he didn't really have anything to say about what is relevant to advanced mathematics. However, what Wittgenstein wants to talk about is not sophisticated mathematics available only to specialists, but what he calls the foundations of mathematics, which must be accessible to all, but which are hard to catch sight of, even though they are in plain view. Wittgenstein never claimed he would try to solve mathematical problems. Now, what then does this kind of synopsis look like? We could, but I guess I have to skip this part. We could, for example, look at Wittgenstein's treatment of the concept of infinity. And in looking at this, we could also, perhaps, I'd like to say, glimpse the strange resemblance between an aesthetic investigation and a philosophical investigation, especially in mathematics. But I don't really think I perhaps have time to do this. But for example, if you look at lecture, I can't remember now which number, well, but one of the lectures where Wittgenstein talks about infinity, I think it gives a very nice example of what Wittgenstein would like to call, or what we could call, synopsis of triviality. He says, what he says are really trivial things about infinity, but by collecting these trivialities and giving us a first picture of Darstellung of them, he sort of makes us realize something about our way of talking about infinity. And this is, okay, mainly, I think, for example, lecture 26 in the Lectures and Foundations of Mathematics gives a clear example of how Wittgenstein wants to change his audience, the way his audience understands infinity within and outside mathematics. And it's interesting to say that Wittgenstein, this is the quotation 22, says about his own procedure, I may occasionally produce new interpretations, not in order to suggest that they are right, but in order to show that the old interpretation and the new are equally arbitrary. I will only invent a new interpretation to put side by side with an old one and say, here, choose, take your pick. I will only make gas to explain old gas. The analogies introduced are what Oscar would like to call objects of comparison that we can use in order to, not in order to get a new picture, but in order to get rid of pictures that are misleading us or stand in the way of a clear view. And for example, when he talks in this lecture about the infinite, he says that when you talk about infinity in mathematics, we sort of automatically get the picture of something huge, because that's how we think of infinity outside mathematics. But it's wrong to think that we know how Aleph Null is used within mathematics if we think it means there are infinitely many so-and-so's, or that the transfinite sets are enormous or huge sets. This is instead, Wittgenstein says, something we have introduced by definition or proof. And he gives a lot of actually quite funny examples of how our use of infinity outside mathematics interferes with our thinking about what we are doing in mathematics or transfinite number theory. For example, we could look at quotation number 23. Wittgenstein says that the sign of confusion, philosophical confusion, is that your head reels. If you feel this dizziness, that's a sign of philosophical confusion. And he says instead that if you want the right image for the transfinite, you mustn't form it from, so to speak, ordinary mathematics. If you say how terrific, if your head reels, you can be sure it's the wrong image. It is not terrific at all. If they say of a child who has learned to multiply, that he has learned Alice Null multiplication, then we have the right image of it. But not if we have the image of Alice Null line trees, which we cannot see the end of. This business about imagery comes from the fact that the mathematical proposition is not about its constituents in the sense in which the sofa is in this room, it's about the sofa. I would have to use more examples, but the question is what can we say about this synopsis of triviality? Of course, all this is very trivial. The facts Wittgenstein presents are things we already knew. But by placing these different pictures side by side and letting us choose or compare, Wittgenstein can make us see something that was not, as he says, in our field of vision. We may come to discover a new aspect which we previously didn't know of, because it was overshadowed by the pictures we formed without reflecting upon it. And here, I see that I referred to the place in the manuscript I quoted at the beginning, where he says that the one-sided lighting also casts a shadow and overshadows things. So we come to quotation number 24. Because I'm not saying that transfinite propositions are false, but that the wrong pictures go with them. And when you see this, the result may be that you lose your interest. It may have enormous consequences, but not mathematical consequences. What Wittgenstein wants to achieve with this kind of compilation is to make us realize that, for example, those parts of mathematics that deal with infinite or infinitesimal numbers have no special depth. They are not about a peculiar reality which is accessible only through mathematics. Instead, it is what we can do with these numbers, this new notation, which is important. Where Kant argued that the introduction of transfinite cardinals was the discovery of a new and exotic mathematical reality, Wittgenstein wants us to see that they are instead introduced by mathematical proof or definition. We are dealing with a mathematical invention, that is a new technique or new conceptualization that does not necessarily even yet have an application. If it doesn't have any application, it is like a loose architrave. The rest of the building is missing, and we have no context that would support this piece of mathematical architecture. And this is a kind of aesthetic criticism you can see in quotation number 25, Wittgenstein says, and this is of course one of Cantor's rules for counting within the transfinite set. These considerations may lead us to say that 2 in the power of Alice Null is larger than Alice Null. That is to say, we can make these considerations lead us to that. Or we can say this and give this as our reason. But if we do say it, what do we do next? In what practice is this proposition anchored? It is for the time being a piece of mathematical architecture which hangs in the air and looks as if it were, let us say, an architrave, but is not supported by anything and supporting nothing. The proposition is worth as much as its grounds are. It supports as much as the grounds that support it do. And well, of course, we can give different interpretations for this, but it could. One possible interpretation could be that Wittgenstein is, for example, not really interested in axiomatic set theory, because that's actually a way of using set theory within mathematics that doesn't really necessarily encounter any of these philosophical problems that Cantor gives expression to. So that's why Wittgenstein actually doesn't say, he really says nothing about axiomatic set theory. Anyway, this is to a certain extent an aesthetic criticism, but it does not, of course, make the questions of the foundations of theory a matter of taste. the point is, as far as set theory has no application, as long as the surroundings are missing, there is no mathematical environment or building where these concepts fit. And as long as that is the case, we have nothing but the charm that these misleading analogies, for example, the analogy between mathematics and natural science, gives us. So Wittgenstein's goal is to make his listeners to see that the similarity of Alice Null and the cardinal number is very small, and to describe the issue so that it loses its charm, as he says in lectures on aesthetics. And this is not something that could be achieved by presenting a number of theses, or by saying, Cantor is wrong, this is what we should be saying instead. Instead, the goal of the philosophical treatment is to change the way we see. And this is perhaps the most important aspect of the strange similarity of this kind of investigation and what Wittgenstein calls an aesthetic investigation. The similarity is evident in the way Wittgenstein proceeds, which I haven't given enough examples of. He makes various comparisons, he invokes alternative pictures, sets them side by side, and so on. As he says himself in the quotation from the manuscript 1116, he wants to compile, to make a surveyable and comprehensive presentation, and he basically has a blind-headed darstellung about these pictures, illustrations, and beliefs. And this overview, I mean, that it sort of reveals the things that cause unclarity. A successful investigation, here as in aesthetics, means that we see something we have been blind to, that we understand, for instance, why a particular musical phrase has a certain effect, or why it is misleading to treat Alice Null analogously with finite cardinals. Successful treatment results in a kind of satisfaction, which stems from the fact that something that puzzled or irritated me, that I could not put my finger on, disappears. I may be cured from the dizziness I felt, and so on. And in philosophy, at least, the successful completion of the investigation can be described by saying that we now see the world correctly, or that we have achieved clarity. there's still one part to my paper which I perhaps just skipped, but this is a discussion of whether Wittgenstein actually leaves mathematics as it is, whether this kind of investigation actually, as Wittgenstein says, doesn't interfere at all with mathematics. But I would just like to quote before I end, have a look at the quote number 26, which is from the big typescript. And the first sentence there, because there Wittgenstein says, a philosopher feels changes in the style of derivation which contemporary mathematician passes over calmly with a blank face. And here we have the same words that in this longer version of the remark about the clear semblance, mit seinen Stumpfen Geschicht. So I think that this is a quite clear allusion actually from Wittgenstein's part about what kind of investigation he is talking about. But here, of course, he gives expression to a kind of optimism that this kind of philosophical investigation actually might change the way mathematicians go on. Philosophical clarity will have the same effect on the growth of mathematics, he says here, as sunlight has on the growth of papyrus. So, but I think that here Wittgenstein, as we talked about yesterday, that in the early 30s he still has this more strong and optimistic notion about what philosophy can do. But if we compare this to quotation number 27, which is later, it is this famous quotation about the fitness of the time, there is much more pessimistic about what the philosophy, or at least what a single philosopher, can do. actually complete claims that he's talking about set theory also in this quotation, but I'm not quite sure about that. Well, as I said, I think I have used up my time. I would still have some things to say about why Wittgenstein thinks it's so dangerous to think about mathematics in a certain way, like assimilating mathematics to natural sciences. And okay, I can't resist quoting or having that we have a look at quotation number 32, because that I think it's a very optimistic by Wittgenstein. He said the dangerous and deceptive thing about the idea that the real numbers cannot be arranged in series or the set dot 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 is not enumerable is that it makes the determination of a concept formation look like a fact of nature. So looking at mathematics as sort of a description of reality makes it sort of, in a sense, incontrovertible and not a human practice which can be changed and reformed. So this is the aspect that Wittgenstein wants to think is sort of dangerous about certain ways of speaking about mathematics. Okay, I'm losing my voice too, so now it's a good time for me to stop. And sorry about the simplistic approach here. Okay, thank